Blog Talk Radio.
Christmas. Merry Christmas to one and all. You found us, Masonic Effects. Welcome. Welcome. Pull up your seat or relax where you are and join us. We'll attempt to share the spirit of this season. Regardless, nothing to do with the nature of your faith. It's the calmness, the tranquility. Yeah, it's Christmas time is energizing. Look at the shopkeepers plying their trade, looking to make their profit for the year, all within the space of one season. Yeah, it's easy enough to lose track of what's important and what's meaningful. You can see that. You look out the window and see, and here, well, we've allowed ourselves to succumb to commercialism, constant. We've allowed ourselves to be haunted by this specter that follows us everywhere, every time, as if the price of exchange of information is to pay a price to listen to somebody hawking their wares. Set it aside. You know, it's like being distracted by the smell of bread when somebody's trying to interrupt you. It's like, come on, I'm hungry. I'm going to sit down here and have a cup of tea and maybe I'll make some toast and relax. The efforts don't matter. And when they don't matter, we see that folks will, you know, they'll try and do just about anything to grab our attention. We've developed these things called algorithms, you know, little decision trees and attempt to anticipate you and I to not only grab our attention, but to hold it. For some nefarious or ulterior reason, it's made me think as I've become older, what the world would be like if instead of succumbing to commercialism, that our media was committed to the development of human beings at every sound, every moment, every thought, enhancement, the enrichment of our experience. Yeah, we've learned that we've learned that salacious sells product. You know, we would sell anything, no matter who it defiled, or the underlying wink, wink, nudge, nudge, don't we all get the real message? But we celebrate now having conscience, having looked at it and looked at the results of doing that. We have no business making ourselves feel good at the expense of other people. No business at all. And we knew it. It takes a concerted effort for adults to teach children to do that. Naturally, kids are much more egalitarian, and it's us. We really teach. We have to get in there and teach hatred and teach judgment and fear and abuse, you know, how to use power and things like that. That's on us. But oh my goodness, step back, 2022, we've really had an opportunity to, I think, handed to us to realize that we are a small community of 8 billion people. Though the small community extends all over the place, and it's pretty remarkable. What's also kind of remarkable is that we enjoy believing what we want to believe, regardless of whether it's, you know, if I say the word true, that's going to be caving in on me, whether it's factual or not, factually based. We are collectively a part of something that's much bigger than ourselves. I'm speaking, you know, of humanity, of our nations, of our cultures, and in a small, select way, masonry. Just a pause. A pause and an intelligent conversation. Regardless of, you know, how it's practiced, that really isn't important. It's the values. Do we, in our own way, learning them, equips us to take some action in some way. And that some way and some action is entirely within our grasp. Entirely. As much as anybody has control. This time of year, we also, I think, acknowledge the fates. In spite of the fears of our ancestors that the sun might not return, and on the mere hope that a token, a sacrifice, might incline favor with the gods at this time of year when we are hungry, becoming more hungry, and there's a chill in the air. Harsher times, even more. Well, we've shaken that image up quite a bit. Just in the last 100 years, where we have more people assuming a sense of luxury, not quite knowing what to do with that, and, you know, fraying at the edges with questions about entitlement and hubris and things like that. What balance that off? Because after a while, you know that's pretty insufferable and intolerable. And that piety, you know, I'm not sure I'm really comfortable with that. I know I'm not, but it usually comes at a price. Yeah? That's part of what I like about the craft, those little phrases and the ideas that if we do this, whatever this is, if we practice and we're bettering our community and our country and our families and neighbors, and to carry out acts of kindness as close to anonymous is, I think, exquisite. Exquisite. Because it leaves recipients with that doubt. This act of kindness could have come from anybody. Oh, it could have been that shoddy, that old fellow sitting on the park bench. It could be the young man rushing home after work to his new bride. It could be. To do those things anonymously is a sweetness. It has a texture to it that's, how do you describe it? It's sublime. It's sublime. Doing things and seeing somebody benefit and have a smile or a sense of goodwill with no need to, no debt, just that feeling, creating that moment of goodwill. You know, the world is a better place, or there's still some decent people in the world, all of that type of truth. It's true. But to be reminded this is a rare, it's very rare, because you're not going to savor, you know, accolades. Something in the ritual about not courting applause. The man who does not court applause, those are the majority of us. The majority of us don't do things because they want a picture or a reward. I worked around hospitals for a great long time, and saw so much heroism and, you know, really important life-saving heroism every single day. But I don't see those folks getting their names in the newspaper and or parade for them, or bridges named after them, or little badges or medals put on their uniforms. I don't see that. But my sense of hero has broadened. And those men and women go home to their families, and they've done that. You know, they've done something remarkable, and they know it. They know it. And to all of them, thanks. You know, you're nameless, but you're out there and you're doing that kind of thing. And it's not just I mentioned that setting because that's familiar to me. But you know these settings. You know these people that are doing things, and if they were caught out, they would be quite upset and probably pull away and deny, you know. No. Just to be able to do something because it's the right thing to do, part of the order that we're in. And this time of year, I think it is, there is some merit to the idea that we can put our lodge life to good use, to, you know, to help sort out and understand our lives in a world that's quite ready to tell us what a proper man should be like. You know, it's there's quite a bit of self-help and lecturing out there. If it didn't start or stop with your lovely parenting, then the reality is not all parenting is healthy. We know that. And the reality is we don't always have Stephen Hawking teaching us physics when we're in high school, do we? No. We get by, and we make, and what we add is the ability to make the best of what we have. And not to lament, well, you know, it was that person, they were an idiot. Where did they ever get their license to teach? Well, enough. You were fortunate enough, and you were looking for more. That's it. Well, all. To a person dying of thirst, they're not going to be too concerned if you're handing them a cup of tea or a bottle of a glass of water. They're not going to be too snooty about it or judgmental about it or preferential. This time of year, it's easier for us to accept the embrace of Freemasonry. It is a harmony. It is a unity that connects us with, hopefully, with ideas and people beyond our horizon, beyond our imagination. And we can review some of the, we should look at these. Do you think it's true? Is it valid that we are alike? At some level, we are alike. So there are, let's take all of the zealots that we can think of. You know, we always, when we have examples, we'll drag out the zealots, you know, people that are, you know, when is the last time a zealot spoke for you? Well, really, you know, it's the same for me. They are out there, and Lord knows they're just part of the spectrum. But they don't own it, and they don't run it. Although they may want to. They never do. Interesting, but that's all they've got. Once that's done, what? Nothing more. That's it. Just follow and listen to your the limits. If you can't handle this, then that limits our outcome. You know, you can't handle much. Well, that's a bit of strange, don't you think? And to assert ideas, knowing full well that your ideas are filtered by your background or lived experience. That's why it's important for us to ask the questions. We're not judging your morality. We're judging you. What kind of person are you? And do you just talk a good line, or do you live accordingly? Well, you and I know, and the world around us, where we are taught a version of persuasion. If I can grant you something, then I have some power and control over you, don't I? You know, if I can give you that raise or that promotion or hire you, I have some leverage, really. The beauty of Masonry is the leverage is us. The leverage is an ability to understand, and then a capacity to find what it feels like to compromise for the sake of the better, for the greater good. What's that feel like? To be able to do that, where we can think, if you're a meager little sort, or you're prone to being very self-critical, too self-critical, you might be reminded that it might be helpful to remind yourself that that there is also a part of us that is understands what we need to do to find the timing between us, to sync up with other people, without feeling that it's in some way degrading or humiliating or a loss of control. You know, those themes that people tell themselves, we need to. And the people that are more fearful, you know, particularly folks with a strong command and control notion, they've got the notion that this is what is necessary for us to live an ordered life. They simply haven't yet been reminded that there's a little more to harmony than just being browbeating people into or telling people what they ought to think. That's lovely. It's like here, I'm going to present you with some music today, and you ought to love it all. You ought to love it all. I'm still carrying on the conversation with you about the beauty of poetry every day, letting poetry into your life. And you know where that conversation's gone. I'm not... Sometimes I'm making a little bit of headway, but you're a complicated lot. You're complex. And when I say things like that, we have So, man, we make inroads at times, but there's always somebody new coming along that says, poetry, what in the world is going? And so do you listen to, do you find the readings of Rumi or the poets of Greece or the contemporaries that I know that are limited by me? There's so much more. What does it do? Well, you know, I've talked about leaning into the conversation, the observation of the poets. And I'm grateful for a lot this time of year, but I'm grateful that poets have the courage to do what I can't say. It's like the same courage to speak the truth about the lies that I tell myself. That's hard, isn't it? That's hard. You think about all the lies you tell yourself to make life a little smoother, allegedly. And then we wrestle with whether we're a good person or not. And Andrew, when we think about it, there's I don't know if Tolstoy was making a point, you know, when you read, for those of you who've had the pleasure of reading War and Peace, was it all just smoke and mirrors? The lie when Napoleon, his troops are coming into Moscow, that this was not a retreat. It was people, old families that were quite in charge of their circumstance, and that the armies, the Russian army at the time, was strategically retreating. Well, you know, he lets us know that it probably wasn't strategic because they were getting beaten. Napoleon was coming on strong, and there was that looseness about the understanding what the strengths and weaknesses of the armies were and the defenders were about. But he leaves you with that complexity, doesn't he? He leaves us with, he's left the world with that complexity, the illusion. Yeah. Well, we're not going to do too much with to tamper with that. I think that's perfect. We've established that we're in a world of fact, a world of conjecture, a world of illusion. We can enjoy it all. We can make the best of it. We can do this. Now the question, can we do this without degrading other people? In some way, well, you know, you've heard me talk about predatory capitalism and all that kind of thing. Yeah, I know. And how this sense of universality and brotherhood, well, you know, that can't be happening. We are salivating over weapons trades. Well, I'm one of those others that believe that we are capable of that global community, and that it's not just science fiction. That it is possible. But right now, media's let us take a look at the big picture. I keep looking back and I think in the 40s and 50s, life was great with blinkers on. And it was great, except if you were a person of color, a minority, a woman, LGBTQ, it wasn't so great. It wasn't so great. And is it better? Well, you would have to ask those folks now. They're older. Do they feel that they're making some progress? Well, in large measure, I'll say for the world, yeah, we are. And we pay a price for that. And no, it's not a complete, absolute kind of a notion. No. But we are in earnest. And we are trying to do things in the name of good, for the cause of good, something that that it stirs a sense of pride and courage in the hearts of people. Aha. The poetry today, I think I had to. Paul Laurence Dunbar, I don't know how many of you might know of Dunbar's work. He's deceased now, a man of color. And he was befriended by Orville Wright. Well, we'll get into one of those Wrights, one of the brothers. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this, just a little bit about Dunbar and his work. It's his poem, Christmas Carol, that I'm drawing out today. I hope that you like the program and you'll sit back and let me share a little bit more about my thinking and notions at this time of year. I'm so very happy to have you sit in with us, and I hope that we entertain you and inform you. My goodness, here, what would Christmas be without music like this? Thank you. Remember? Of course you do. Of course you do. Creation is within. Why not? Hey? Why not tackle something on a large scale? Here are the 7 levels of eternity. We could start off with something. We could end the year with something a little calmer, but that just wouldn't be Masonic effects. Yeah, there's some, by the way, there is some brilliant material out there for us to study. And if you're prone to lectures, there's some taped lectures that are stunning, just beautiful. At whatever stage of interest you are in. And we're bombarded with so much information right now, so much content. Well, think about it. Here you're walking with me, and I'm in a little school, and there's the library is what a couple of shelves of books that fit above the radiators. Not a whole lot. None of the classics. No, a bit of something, probably a compendium on Shakespeare and something like that. General. Then you find your way into a university library, and these beautiful, beautiful, amazing creatures called professional librarians. Oh, just to talk with them, they're like savants. They're like Renaissance. Where do they so much information and so helpful? It's like, oh, and to walk through the stacks and go to a floor where you didn't have necessarily have a book, just to wander and look at the. Do you remember walking and looking at the spines and the names until, and then what would happen? You find something that. Completely, you grab it off the shelf, you take it home, you read it. Oh, it's like bumping into that person that introduced me to Somerset Maugham's, the delicacy of Somerset Maugham's understanding of the human condition. Yeah, it's like that. It's like that. Creation. Out of all the billions of galaxies spread throughout the universe, somehow the ingredients of life converged. Chemistry became material, and material became billions of divisions until we were created, billions of cells. It's a miracle when you think about the odds. We are alone in this inconceivable space. We are as remarkable as what is around us, but we don't see it that way. Is this luck? Is it destiny? Is it by design? Too long ago, I stopped believing the great architect of the universe was a demanding persona. I didn't believe creation was in the hands of Santa. Do good and receive beneficence. No, no. Doing good is no guarantee. Doing good is what a mindful man does. He puts his being and purpose in context. And when we remove fear-based learning, we uncover some interesting facts of our own. We can't control the fates. We can understand them, but we can't control them. But it hardly matters. Life itself is the achievement. When we accept the way happiness is achieved, subordinate to all the other forces and laws at play, we begin a self-satisfying smile. All that philosophical stuff, that's always been the grist of this mill. Take whatever opportunity presents itself to reinforce what is good and just for you. That's beautiful. You are. Christmassy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's a bit more. Here's a bit more. Feel good story, I think. Paul Lawrence Dunbar. This is a time in 1890 in Dayton, Ohio, in a central high school class. It's kind of odd. There's 28 in the class. There were two world-class prodigies who were destined to become world famous. One was Orville Wright, who with his brother Wilbur invented the plane. The other was Paul Lawrence Dunbar, who became the first African-American to gain national eminence as a poet and the founder of African-American popular literature. Orville and Paul knew each other well while they were in school. He was very talented in writing and literature, and he would help Orville with his school assignments in those subjects. And in return, Orville would help Paul with math and science. I have friends like these today, and they're just lovely, and they're so generous with their knowledge. The accompanying, here we see a class, Orville and Paul. Orville began a printing business while he was still in high school. Audacious thing, you know what you think? And it was the first to print Dunbar's writings, including advertising flyers and tickets for poetry recitals. One was a neighborhood newspaper edited by Paul called the Dayton Tattler. Once Dunbar wrote on the wall of the Wright's print shop some humorous graffiti: "Orville Wright is out of sight in the printing business. No other mind is half so bright as his is." When later Orville and Wilbur were in the business of manufacturing bicycles, they gave one to Paul. It's on display. Undeniable things about the Americans is the celebration of history. Yeah. Let's not go too far into that. It's Christmas. Orville never received his high school diploma because he dropped out of school before his senior year to work full-time on his printing and newspaper business. But Paul did graduate, and he was quite a good student. He had a distinguished record. But he did have trouble with trig. Wouldn't be the only one. And he had to retake the course, which delayed his graduation. He was a member of the Debating Society, editor of the school newspaper, president of the school's literary society, and also wrote the lyrics to the class song. It sounds like an interesting enough guy. In my day, he would have been known as a geek or a nerd and probably avoided. Now he's what, CEO? But Paul obtained fame and fortune before the Wrights. But his future didn't look very bright after graduation. So with most unknown artists, he couldn't make a living writing poetry, and he couldn't find a job befitting his education because he was black. Carried on. He was a man. He found a job as an elevator operator in a Dayton office building and turned that into an opportunity. He sold his first book of poetry, Oak and Ivy, at the age of 20 for $1 each to passengers he met on the elevator. Dunbar asked Orville to publish the book, but Orville's printing shop lacked the equipment to bind books. Orville recommended he use the United Brethren Publishing House in downtown Dayton. Orville's dad, Milton Wright, was a bishop of the United Brethren Church and in charge of the publishing operations. There was some dispute over how many of the books were published, but the estimate ranges from 300 to 500. It's estimated around 200 still exist. In March of 2006, one of these books appeared on eBay with a starting bid of $2,000. The book is estimated to be worth somewhere between $5,000 and $6,000 today. Gradually, Dunbar's reputation spread. The break came when he was invited to recite his poems at the 1893 World's Fair. Yeah, that one. And there he met Frederick Douglass, the famous abolitionist, who was impressed with the young poet and gave him a job. His second break came from attorney Charles Thatcher and psychiatrist Henry Tobey, who enjoyed his poems and arranged for recitations at literary meetings and funded the publication of Dunbar's second book of poems, Majors and Minors. This book came to the attention of William Dean Howells, a novelist and critic, and the dean of the late 19th century American Letters, who was also a friend and advisor to Mark Twain. Howells' praise of Dunbar's second book in the Harper's Review launched Dunbar into the big time among literary circles. The two books of poems were subsequently combined into one named Lyrics of a Lowly Life, with an introduction by Howells, and it became a bestseller. With Dunbar's national fame now established, he traveled to London in 1897 to recite his poems. Dayton wrote his first poem when he was only 6 years old and recited publicly at age 9 and was now an international celebrity. And after returning from London, he married Alice Ruth Moore, herself a writer and a teacher and a proponent of racial and gender equality. Paul settled down into a job at the Library of Congress at Washington, D.C., and then tragedy. He developed tuberculosis. His marriage dissolved, and declining health led him to dependence on alcohol and depression. He returned to Dayton in 1904, a year after the Wright brothers' famous first flight, and bought a home for his mom that is now the Dunbar House Museum. He knew he was going to die soon. She took care of him while he continued to write until his premature death in 1906 at the age of 34. His mom, Matilda, who had been born into slavery, lived on to her 95th birthday. She had a great influence on his life. It was she who urged him to educate himself and encouraged his talent. During his short lifetime, Dunbar wrote 600 poems, 12 books of poetry, 5 novels, 4 volumes of short stories, musicals. His musical, Tuskegee Song, was adopted as the alma mater for the school founded by his friend, Booker T. Washington. Mm-hmm. Dunbar's mom and dad, Joshua and Matilda, had been slaves in Kentucky. Joshua escaped and served as a sergeant in the 55th Massachusetts Infantry and 5th Massachusetts Colored Cavalry during the Civil War. He and Matilda separated in 1874 when Paul was only 12. University of Dayton poet Herbert Martin says that Dunbar's use of Negro dialect spoke in slave days in some of his poems was controversial to some of his modern readers who believed the use of dialect as a detriment and possibly demeaning to blacks. Martin believes that anyone who cringes at Dunbar's use of dialect must have second thoughts about listening to rap or vernacular speech. Martin believes Dunbar sees the humanity, not a stereotype. His ear was marvelously accurate. When he wrote about joys and sorrows of life, especially the difficulties experienced by African Americans. You can find more about that in his poem, We Wear the Mask. I'll read this poem, Christmas Carol, by this young man, Paul Laurence Dunbar. Oh, was he helped by Orville? Yes, he was. No, celebrity breeds celebrity. Eh? Bit of validity at a time that's in some circles is still with us. Ring out ye bells, all nature swells with gladness at the wondrous story. The world was lorn, but Christ is born to change our sadness into glory. Sing, earthlings, sing, tonight a king hath come from heaven's high throne to bless us. The outstretched hand o'er all the land is raised in pity to caress us. Come to his call, be joyful all, away from mourning and with sadness. The heavenly choir with holy fire, their voices raise in songs of gladness. Ah, the darkness breaks, and dawn awakes, her cheeks suffused with youthful blushes. The rocks and stones in holy tones are singing sweeter than the thrushes. Why then should we in silence be when nature lends her voice in praises, when heaven and earth proclaim the truth of him for whom that lone star blazes? No, be not still, but with a will strike all your harps and let them singing. On hill and heath, let every breath throw all its power to singing. Huh. Thanks, Paul. Just might do. Here, history. How does, you know, talk about the history of Paul Laurence Dunbar? Portion specific isn't the only thing is historical about this, but well, about the shows. Here, though, we're back visiting masonry in Holland, in the Netherlands, all those provinces there. we're discovering some things, noticing some things at the safety, you know, time gives us some safety. We can look at sensitive topics and revisit them and see, you know, do they still trigger the same kind of reactions, or have we become a little bit more sophisticated or worldly or understanding? Here, as I look at the portion today, it begins, at the center stands the temple of virtue. Oh my goodness, here we go again. Whatever that means, living a virtuous life. Well, I don't think we need to be taught all of that. I think there's things about us inherent that knows instinctively what a virtue is about. And in its center shines a primitive light, the light of reason. Not too far away, is it? Reason, understanding, equipped with it. It sort of makes me feel a bit vindicated. I roll my eyes. I'm one of those. I roll my eyes. What's the sound that I was taught? Bible thumping. You know, this is the way it is. It's fire and brimstone. Never bought it. Still don't. But that didn't stop it, eh? Here's virtue. You and I are of that bunch that is also aware of the light. And this lodge, we talked about this. The Loge du Juste took a small animal, the ermine, with its precious coat and fastidious manner. You know what I mean? As a symbol of its proud and elegant search for virtue and reason. A symbol. Adorning a pictorial representation of the animal was the motto, I would rather die than defile myself. In the ritual for the reception of a master and mistress, the virtue sought is specifically identified as Christian, an identification that does not appear in other exclusively male lodges from the same place and period. Yet in other parts of the records, virtues are simply named, with a distinction being made solely between the non-Masons, le profane masculin et féminin, and those initiated into, quote, the light of all grades of Masonry of adoption. The overwhelming impression left by the records of the lodge concerns virtue. The ethos of this lodge centered on moral improvement, on reason and work as the means to self-knowledge and worth. Such sentiments were commonplace in other exclusively male lodges for that period, but in those lodges, virtue was more overtly linked to the well-being of society and, more important, to governance. The lodges for men and women only indirectly embraced a larger political reality. In the 18th century, the constitutional ideal, the creation of constitutionally governed civil societies, was masculine work. The lodges of adoption provided access to that ideal and, inadvertently, they were primarily schools of manners and virtue. Yet their brothers had to acknowledge that while aspects of Masonry remained purposefully hidden from their sisters, this new association of men and women without number, who in civil society scarcely have contact, are united together by the sweet bonds of fraternity. And so the conversation continues. It continues. No apology, I think. There's something different that we want to explore as men. Without the distraction or the ingredient or the addition of women, no. In that way, there is a solitude about about masonry. And I don't think it I don't think it harms us. I think it's difficult when people aren't aware of that solitude. Why? Because obviously we're fragile, and there comes a time when we want to examine without being examined. We want to see that connection. And for a lot of us, just to understand the maleness in us, it is interesting, isn't it? Well, I see that we're coming to a lovely, lovely conclusion for this. Belabor the point. I don't think I ever do. We just get enthusiastic. There's things to share. Masonry, we'll continue with the conversation. It's we haven't even 10 or 12 years now. We just scratched the surface, gentlemen and ladies, brethren, I should add. And there's more, far more than can come out of my mediocrity. I'm continuously impressed by ideas that you have, that you share, your mastery, often without, you know, without trying to assert yourself. It's just pretty remarkable how well read the people are that are around me. And yes, it is daunting for our entered apprentices that find that, oh my goodness, here I am talking to a guru, somebody that is so well read. Well, yeah, that's always been the case. But these are men that have, they're just so persuasively cordial. They're willing to, the hard part is, it's like, what's that notion, imposter syndrome? It's like seeing a new Mason, I couldn't possibly do that. And then gradually working with them until they begin their own journey, their own exploration, their own development. Here, this is, I found, one of the most charming pieces of music. This is from the Philharmonic Orchestra of Nuremberg, and they were playing outside on the 14th of June 2014. Yep, this Ode to Joy, and I wish you and yours a fine holiday, and may the spirits be with you always. Eh? Merry Christmas. So from Beethoven and the Philharmonic of Nuremberg and me, Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. See you at New Year's.